turning to the current situation, which is on what's on most of our minds. Joe Cirincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund, who I greatly admire, has said the greatest nuclear threat right now lives in the White House. And I think there's some legitimacy to that. This is not to take away any of the blame that rightly falls on the Russian Federation, that rightly falls on North Korea. But I think what's on most people's mind is President Trump. And the three presenting crises are North Korea and the Iran deal and the budget. And North Korea, I think, has vaulted to the front of the pack. The crisis with North Korea, basically, is that they are testing increasingly powerful nuclear weapons and increasingly long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles. And what this means is that they are looking for the capacity, at least, to threaten cities on the United States mainland. North Korea has said quite overtly, quite self-consciously, that they see themselves as wanting to be the exception to Libya and Iraq, two countries that gave up their programs for weapons of mass destruction and subsequently had their regimes overthrown by outside powers. That they don't want that to happen to themselves, which, without giving any illusions about North Korea's virtue, it is, I think, it is defies superlatives, the human rights abuse and wickedness that goes on in that place. From a purely sort of rational perspective, you can see where they're coming from. They seem committed to a course of strategic parity with the United States before they talk, and the United States seems committed to stopping that. So there's no openness to dialogue, and that's been exacerbated by what I think is needless rhetoric that really feels more apt for the playground than the international stage. The President Trump saying he's going to bring fire and fury like the world has never seen. He's going to totally destroy North Korea. Secretary of State Tillerson said we'll continue diplomacy until the first bomb drops. And President Trump evidently told Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham, that if thousands die, they're going to die over there, not over here. So the U.S. Is moving, prepared to be moving by force to destroy North Korea's strategic capacity. But let's be clear. If the U.S. destroys a missile on the launch pad, that is war with North Korea. And the problem with North Korea is that they've got massive artillery and massive infantry about 30 miles from a city of 25 million people. So they could kill hundreds of thousands of people without ever launching a nuclear weapon, and it's basically impossible to remove that capacity in a military way. So there's a situation without a military solution that's careening toward a military conflagration. Estimations of the casualties of the first day of open conflict on the Korean Peninsula range from 300,000 to 1 million if it goes nuclear. If there were the retaliation on Seoul and Tokyo, which is entirely expected, then the dead could number well over 2 million in a day. A friend of mine who's deeply knowledgeable about North Korea, who knows a number of people in that country, has said that they will absolutely take down the region with them if they feel that the regime is under attack. There are 230,000 U.S. citizens in Korea, which include 28,000 U.S. troops, many, many more in Japan, which is also under threat. And I just ask you as a thought experiment to think about what the United States' reaction was to 3,000 dead in the suicide bombings of 9/11, and what the response would be if 100,000 U.S. citizens were killed in a day. There's an effort to push back. In Congress, there is a bill in the House and the Senate to bar the president's ability to order a unilateral first nuclear strike. There's another resolution barring a U.S. attack on North Korea altogether, without congressional approval. My personal conviction, it's opinion, I'm not a mind reader, I haven't read any secret documents, but my personal conviction is that we are in a situation remarkably similar to that leading up to Iraq, that there are elements within the administration that want a war, not because they like death and destruction, but because out of their concern for the, I'm putting myself in a different mindset than the one I tend to occupy, but because they believe that North Korea cannot be allowed to be the counterexample to Iraq and North Korea, to Iraq and Libya, that it shouldn't matter, that if you acquire that weapons of mass destruction are no, you are not safe from the punitive consequences leveled by the United States. And so all the rhetoric to me sounds to me like an administration that's trying to create the illusion of going through a process, but which already knows what it wants. Last night, when you're in Asia, the two are confused. President Trump gave a speech to the Korean and South Korean Assembly, which establishes a precondition for talks with North Korea, denuclearization, and the end of their missile program, which is the highest hanging fruit that would be at the end of negotiations with them. And he said it's the preconditions for sitting down to talk, which is sort of like saying, I'm really interested in interfaith dialogue with you, you just have to convert to Christianity first. I think that this is rhetoric that is designed to look open while shutting a door. I hope I'm wrong. I really hope I'm wrong. I don't have any cheerful conclusion to that. I wake up every morning checking the news to see what I fear the most. The Iran deal is not even a footnote. It's another crisis in the making, but it's like reading Kafka. There is no reason to eliminate this deal yet. President on the campaign said it was the worst deal in history, which is remarkable news for the Russians, given that we bought Alaska for them for like $10. It's the worst deal in history, and so he couldn't bring himself to do the 90-day certification that it was in the national interest. And so he decertified it and kicked it back to Congress, and if Congress imposes sanctions, it amounts to a unilateral renegotiation of that deal. Iran will pull out, they will have the moral high ground, and there will be absolutely no supervision over their nuclear capacities whatsoever. It is, again, an easy way to go to war if you want it. Add to that, there is the backdrop of a nuclear modernization plan that President Obama agreed to as the price of getting the New START treaty. He agreed to spend $1 trillion over 30 years modernizing America's nuclear weapons. The actual price tag has now come out at $1.2 to $1.5 trillion over 30 years. And when you're spending that kind of money on something over three decades, you're not really in a position to get rid of it. So the summary is, it's not good. The summary is, it's not good. And we are in this crisis, I think, of memory of which way are we going to go with these things. Here's just some quick facts. I should have cycled through this, but I didn't want to belabor the details. As you can see, the U.S. and Russia still possess 93% of all nuclear warheads. Everyone else is in the hundreds region. There are a set of countries that maintain high-alert nuclear weapons, which mean they could be launched within 5 minutes or so. That's certainly true of the United States. So what to think? How to react to this as Christians? I think the question is, what's the distinctly Christian response here? What's the particularly Christian response here? I mean, look at me. We're standing in the shadow of a cathedral. I'm wearing this. So what's the distinctly Christian response to the situation? Well, we have to acknowledge that some Christians are pushing for war, and some non-Christians are urging peace. So there's nothing particularly Christian about not wanting a nuclear war. You don't need a personal relationship with Jesus not to want to be blown up. And I think the first step, therefore, for me, is humility, just recognizing that Christians don't have a lock on moral reasoning. But within that, there is, I think, a place for a distinctly Christian response, and here's my contention, that if Christian activism is to be Christian, it must be a witness and a testimony to the Lord we serve, which is to say, our activism must, in its motivation, method, and substance, reflect the revelation of God and Jesus Christ and proclaim the gospel, that he died for our sins according to the scriptures, that in his blood shed on the cross, God is pleased to make peace with all things in heaven and on earth, that those who trust in the faith and righteousness of the sacrifice of Christ are entrusted with that same peacemaking vocation that they have been the beneficiaries of, and become peace emissaries to the world, offering God's extended offer of peace through them and offering peace with one another. So if that's the case, what's the Christian response to nuclear weapons and the anxiety of our age? I want to go through three levels of it, and I think it goes deeper and deeper and deeper. The first level of Christian engagement, and this is more historical, is about when and whether and how it's okay to use nuclear weapons. And this is the just war tradition, which I am sympathetic to in many respects. The just war tradition, described in its the words of John Howard Yoder, a theologian who was one of its most incisive critics, was to say that in a particular cases, there are actions that inflict harm in a responsibly structured way are morally preferable to letting some adversary inflict some other harm, which one can argue would be greater. That is, in some cases, it is more loving to go to war than to suffer it. You can agree with that or not, but it has been the ethical framework that has governed Christian thinking about armed conflict in some manner for the better part of the last 1,500 years. It applies to nuclear weapons. Just war is known principally for its set of criteria: when it's okay to go to war, and if you're in war, how you can wage war. And nuclear weapons are principally related to two of the criteria of how you wage war. So just war depends on being able to discriminate between combatant and non-combatant. That's a core criterion of it, as well as proportionality, that the damage done must be proportional to the conflict at hand. And so when we think of those things which nuclear weapons are unable to do, the question that arises, I think, is what distinguishes nuclear weapon from, say, the fire bombings of Tokyo or Dresden or Coventry that happened in World War II? What distinguishes them from the use of conventional weapons, which is not discriminatory, which is not proportional? More people died in the firebombing of Tokyo than either of the atomic bombings. It was much more lethal. So why is it different? Why do we talk about nuclear weapons as if they were a sui generis category in the just war theory? And what I would present to you is that nuclear weapons represent the weaponization of a tactic that is categorically forbidden in the just war tradition. So there is a way of being indiscriminate. There is a way of being non-proportional. And what nuclear weapons do is they take that out of the realm of human decision-making and they weaponize that tactic in the bomb itself. Now, it's possible to imagine cases in which nuclear weapons would be detonated and be discriminatory and proportional that wouldn't violate just war, but they mostly involve Bruce Willis. And none of them are plausible in real life. That's the thing. It's like you will get these military planners who will give you these sort of far-fetched scenarios of, you know, well, there's an army in the middle of the Gobi Desert and we put a small nuclear weapon on them. And you sort of think to yourself, well, okay, I mean, yes, I suppose you could come up with a hypothetical situation that's going to satisfy ticking the boxes here. But in real life, what we know is that people act irrationally and people act with emotion, and nuclear weapons are going to violate these categories. The other aspect of nuclear weapons is that there's this taboo. They haven't been used in 72 years and counting. It's a meaningful taboo, and breaking the taboo will make them more usable. There is simply no way to align nuclear weapons with the criteria of what's called macro proportionality, of saying it has to do more good than harm. There's this little verse in Deuteronomy that I love, Deuteronomy 20:19. It says, when the Israelites are making war, they can cut down trees to make siege engines to besiege a city, but they're not to cut down the fruit trees, because the fruit trees are for the benefit of humankind. And the principle I see enshrined here is that we are not to imagine that the conflicts of our day are the conflicts of future generations to come. So wage what wars you will, but don't take away the apples of your grandchildren. And that's precisely what nuclear weapons do. This categorical distinction means that nuclear that's where I would sum up the just war tradition. But then as we take it a step deeper, because nuclear weapons offer this particular categorical distinction within the just war tradition, I also think they bear on questions of political theology. And I'm going to try and go through this quickly because it's a sort of arcane argument, but I thought it was worth presenting. The humanitarian impact of nuclear weapons discourse that I mentioned sought to shift the debate from how and when to use the nuclear weapons, the just war type questions, to what do the weapons do? And what they found was that any use of nuclear weapons would have far-reaching, catastrophic, perhaps irreversible consequences on humanitarian effects, ranging from the health consequences of fallout to systemic environmental collapse to an exchange of 100 nuclear weapons could cause a global famine, killing a billion people, to a more extensive could eliminate the ozone layer. And then you've got the worst case, which would literally kill all human beings. The findings of the humanitarian conferences said the risk to the existence of nuclear weapons are underestimated and unacceptable. Said the consequences of nuclear use mean it would contravene international health and humanitarian law, and that consideration of these humanitarian impacts raises profound ethical and moral questions, and I'd add a theological one as well. So here's the gist of the argument. States, countries, do what we don't allow people to do in general, in that they take money and they kill people. And when they do, we don't always call it robbery and murder. We think that there are ways that state, I mean, there may be some of us who think that any action of killing is murder, but I would imagine that most of us live in a world where we can think that some state action, in the terms of a judicious police force, is not murder. Likewise, taxation is not robbery per se. The reason that we don't call these things robbery and murder are because states pair force with authority. This is, and the great church father Augustine said that the authority of the state derived entirely to the degree that it served justice for its people. This is what differentiates a state from a band of robbers. So that's one premise, and I think it's one that we that is biblically grounded from a Christian standpoint, that in, as Romans 13 would articulate, the maintenance of social order is a divine command, and it is grounded in the ability to provide justice for a people. Fast forward to the great scholastic theologian Thomas Aquinas, who added to the political theology of Augustine in many ways by saying that if a ruler does not act legitimately, if they exceed their authority, or if they contravene its purpose, then they become a tyrant and they are illegitimate and they should not be obeyed. So when you pair these two together, what you have is the contention, a Christian theological contention, that a state that is not acting justly forfeits its right, its authority, to claim a mandate for taking money or killing. That if it is not acting with justice, it is in fact acting simply as a robber or as a murderer with rank. And that all that it might do, though it pretends it has the right to do it as a state, is a facade, it's a scam. And that in that case, when a state is acting without justice, the moral culpability that a state, the mantle of state authority and state justice usually, the moral immunity that that usually gives to its officers disappears. And we have a contemporary example, or a living memory of example of this with the Court of Nuremberg, that said there's no state authority that ever could have ordered those concentration camps. You had no right. It was beyond your capacity because they defied justice. And because they defied justice, no mantle of state authority can protect the people who initiated the actions, and so the moral culpability devolves to the individual rather than to being spread to the state. Where am I going with this? A state that causes harm to its own people opposes the purpose of its authority and justice. And a state that inhibits the ability of another state to serve its own people exceeds its competency. And what that means is if you take the humanitarian findings seriously, and if they are accurate, and I think they are, then you say that nuclear weapons present an unjust set of risks and harms that cannot be bound to the service of justice. And if that is true, then it means that a state using or threatening or relying on nuclear weapons has compromised its state constituting authority and is ordering something that it actually has no right to order. as the entity that it is. It means that states can't actually use nuclear weapons, which is a hard thing to wrap your mind around, because who else is going to use nuclear weapons except the terrorists? 5 years ago, that would have been this entire presentation, but that's a whole different kettle of radioactive fish. So states can't actually use nuclear weapons as states any more than they can build concentration camps as states and say, this is a legitimate program of our authority. And if nuclear weapons violate justice in this way, then we should maybe start looking at them like concentration camps with jet boosters and rocket wings, which are not protected by the mantle of state authority. And I would call us to account for the degree to which we have grown so comfortable and familiar with them, like the little boy who walks past the camp day after day, so long that ivy grows on its walls, so long that it seems venerable, justifiable, yet at the heart there is an absence of justice that cannot be justified. And no matter how familiar it has become, because, oh, we have these things, but they are not like those things, they are not like those camps. In fact, they are. They are devoid of justice. And what that means is that all our pretensions to using them are a sham. They're murder with government headlines. The radical implications of this, cribbing from Aquinas, is that commands from rulers regarding unjust things are by definition unlawful. And what I think this means is that you shouldn't be able to trust a Christian nuclear officer. And yet, there is still a deeper theological layer yet to the Christian witness on nuclear weapons, which goes beyond even what they do to the bodies they do it to.